Okay, I'd like to thank the organizers of the conference and the KITP. It's really a pretty impressive array of work. I'm happy to be presenting in its midst. So this work supported by the NSF and the ARO, and this is my group, and I'll talk a little bit more about them as we go along. What I'm going to start off with is a theory of 1D Bose gases with delta interactions, and it's a really a very, at least a large part of the audience is very specialized, so I don't really mean to be saying I'm going to really give the theory of 1D Bose gases, but what I'll do is I'll give everyone enough that they can understand what's important through the talk that I'm going to give. So even if you don't have a broad familiarity in thucydides, I should be able to give you what you need. And then I'll talk about experiments with delta function interacting Bose gases in one dimension, and then experiments out of equilibrium with delta function Bose gases in one dimension. And then, sort of part of natural progression, I'll talk about experiments that are not quite delta function interacting and not quite 1D Bose gases, and see what happens with those. So the motivations for this work, for working with 1D Bose gases, are manifold. One of the things, in a way, it's the most important point, because so many things derive from this, is that these can be integrable many-body systems. And integrable systems are something which is very rare in many-body physics. There are extremely few examples, and now we have a system which can actually implement that system in the lab. So that gives you, first off, exact theoretical results in equilibrium. With 1D, you can get to strong coupling physics, which is otherwise hard to do with gases. You can do it in optical lattices when you but you pay certain things to be doing experiments in optical lattices. By confining in one dimension, you can get to strong coupling in a sort of organic way. You can also get to weak coupling. And these sorts of experimental systems give you ultimately control over integrability. Right? So integrability is something we start off with, and then it's something we can then modify. So the experiments I'll be talking about are in optical lattices. It's been talked about a lot. The important thing to realize about the optical lattice is that you have a trap which is proportional to the intensity, that is a potential energy proportional to the intensity. You can make a 1D optical lattice with just a retroreflected beam that gives you a stack of pancakes of atoms. You have a 2D optical lattice where you can find tightly in two directions that gives you an array of tubes. You have a 3D optical lattice, you get an array of points. And I point at all these different dimensions because in my lab we actually use, in different experiments, each one of these. We use 1D lattice as a trap for doing an electron-electric dipole moment. We make 1D Bose gases out of these tubes from a 2D optical lattice. And then we do a quantum computing experiment with a 3D optical lattice. The people who are doing the various work and are listed here in the EDM experiment. 1D Bose gases, Toshiya and Trevor did most of the work I'll be talking about are pictured here, and that work is now continuing with a new postdoc and grad student. And there's a quantum computing team. I'm going to actually stick something in the outline, which wasn't in the outline, which is to talk a little bit about the experiment on quantum computing. I'll just talk about it briefly, but we're reasonably excited about the results, and I'd just like to show it to you. So what we create is an optical lattice with a spacing between sites which is about 5 microns. And we do this with a blue detuned lattice with atoms at small angles. We load a lot of atoms and then laser cool, and in laser cooling we end up with half the sites with one atom at them, and it's a single atom. So each of those points over, each of those bright dots is just a single atom, which we can image steady state. So this is a real-time video of atoms in this lattice. You can see at the edge where the lattice is shallow, occasionally you see an atom site hop. In the center, the atoms are just fixed. You know, the only thing which happens is eventually they collide with a background gas atom and you lose them. But otherwise, we can just sit there and watch them. So it's possible, therefore, to take this, and I'd say that so the bright spots are atoms. The diffuse haze are atoms that are also trapped at a single site, but out of focus. Right, so you can focus on one plane and then move a lens and focus on another plane, move a lens, focus on another plane, and then if you go and do the same thing with the same distribution, you get the same pictures. So the plan with this is to laser cool these atoms to their vibrational ground state and then fill the vacancies with a procedure which, because you can check to make sure that it's perfect, in the end can give you something which is a perfect distribution. It's an exact filling around some central region, and then implement quantum gates. Okay, but that's an aside. We'll come back to the central topic of the talk, which is 1D Bose gases. The field really started with Marvin Girardeau in 1960, who considered a 1D Bose gas with infinite hardcore repulsion. Because it costs an infinite amount of energy for two particles to be in the same place, you get the phenomenon of fermionization. So we showed that the many-body wave function for bosons is formally equivalent to, within this absolute value sign, to the many-body wave function for fermions. And the cartoon picture that I'll be using to refer to this is here, where if you take a boson and it's trapped over some length, you might find that boson anywhere. Right? The boson is not localized in one place. But if you find a boson at any particular place, if it's a Tonks-Girardeau gas, you won't find another particle at the same place. Right? So this picture here is a picture of the two particle correlations, showing that there's no possibility of finding two particles in the same place. So although the particle's wave functions very smoothly, this trick, which is the second order correlation function goes to zero, is a trick of extreme correlation. So this thing over here, where it looks like nothing's going on with the particles, is actually a highly correlated many-body wave function. And so that's a strongly coupled state. So a very short time later, it's interesting that you've seen this picture just in the previous talk, Lieb and Linegar solved this problem, which is more general. They said, you don't want to have infinite interactions, because that's really not that physical. You'll have some variable interaction in your delta function. So the potential was just kinetic energy term for every particle, and then an interaction, delta function interaction term with a variable amplitude for every pair of particles. And they show that you can solve this and get solutions which are parametrized like this. So they parametrized by dimensionless constant gamma, and it can be exactly solved for any value of gamma. So to consider what the two important limits, one, gamma is much greater than one, that's the Tonks-Girardeau gas. Gamma is much, much less than one, then you get a Thomas Fermi gas where mean field theory applies. So the cartoon picture of the Tonks-Girardeau gas is that the kinetic energy associated with keeping these particles from overlapping is the dominant energy term, whereas there's no similar kinetic energy term for the mean field for the Thomas Fermi gas. It's just the mean field energy which dominates. So if you want to get into this region, you can see by looking at gamma, you can either increase the coupling strength, which makes sense, that's the strongly coupled gas, or you can decrease the density, right? Which also makes sense, although it's a little bit counterintuitive when you first see it, right? So you want to get strong coupling, you can have large G1D or low density. So where this field sort of started to become really, instead of just a theoretical playground, which it was for condensed matter theorists for quite a long time, where it became a really experimentally viable thing was in work that Maxime Molchany did in 1998, where he considered a real atomic gas in a waveguide with a real 3D scattering length and some transverse confinement length. And he considered scattering just of two particles within this tube. And he said, you know, if you came in on one wave function, you'd have a possibility of nothing happening, and then some scattering amplitude for the particles to reflect off each other. And the whole premise there is that you don't have enough energy to actually change the transverse vibrational states in this interaction. And then through dot, 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 that's the experimentalist view of a calculation, he gets this result for the amplitude, which is 1 over 1 plus I KZ A1D plus terms that are on the order of the momentum of two particles interacting on the tube times the transverse confinement length cubed. Okay, so and then this A1D is given by this in, you know, in terms of the real parameters in the problem. Now, you can also consider the problem of two particles actually interacting with a real delta function potential of some variable amplitude. And the solution for that is this for the scattering amplitude. So you see that this and this look very much alike if you can make the identification of A1D with this, and you can ignore terms of that order. Right, so the 3D scattering problem maps onto a 1D Bose interact, 1D delta function interacting gas, and this mapping is really a very reliable interaction because we can get to a condition where this is an extremely small number. So from that, you can define a gamma in terms of the real parameters at your disposal. And since usually, although you don't have to, we can readily deal with situations where this term is small, gamma can be simply expressed like that. So if you want to increase gamma in a real experiment, you can increase the 3D scattering length. You can decrease the 1D density, spread the atoms out in the tube, or you can confine them more tightly, decrease the transverse confinement. And for the experiments I'll talk about, we use these two handles, although this handle is certainly there waiting to be used. So the experiments that we do use a number of light traps. So we use a blue detuned optical lattice. Those are the big blue beams here. And that gives an array of tubes. And then the tubes are essentially untrapped in the direction, in this picture it should be out of the screen. So we cap them with not a lattice, but just a dipole beam, which is a variable size, which serves to make it so they don't expand in this direction. Right, so we have two separate traps, one for the axial direction and one for the transverse confinement. So usually I'll be drawing pictures where these tubes are set off in this direction. And I draw the tubes like this just because the tubes really, the lattice does very little confinement of the atoms in the axial direction. And that's a feature of this blue detuning. Right? It has the advantage of minimizing spontaneous emission because the atoms are sending at low intensity points, but it also gives you extremely weak axial trapping. It's not just the red detuned trapping with the opposite sign. It's because you're sitting there where there's very little intensity, there's very weak axial trapping. And that allows us to independently adjust the longitudinal trapping along the axis and the transverse trapping. Right? Transverse trapping is just the depth of the lattice. Longitudinal trapping is the size of these beams or their intensity of these dipole beams. So just to remind you why experimentally this is 1D, it's because all the energies in the problem are much less than the energy needed to excite to the next vibrational level. And also, we can get to a situation where the traps are deep enough that there's negligible tunneling among these various tubes. So to do this, to increase gamma, what we actually do is either increase the lattice power or decrease the dipole trap power to make the density go down. What we often measure is the expansion of these atoms in 1D, and that gives us access to the total energy. So this is looking at a whole bunch of tubes edge on. You're not resolving them because there's about, in that picture, about 1,000 tubes, 250 atoms per tube. And we release them, but we release them by taking off the dipole trap, not capping them anymore, but they still stay in the tubes. So they do an expansion, which is completely within the tubes. And eventually, as they expand enough, all the energy that they had in this condition comes out in kinetic energy along the tubes. And that's what we measure. And just to give a scale for the problem, the tubes are much longer than this, right? In terms of this room, the actual length of the tubes, because the waist size of the lattice is very large, the tubes would actually expand outside this room. Okay, so we're preparing them right in the very center, and then we're still looking at them expanding while they're still in essentially the same exact one-dimensional space. Okay, so I said that's a way to get access to the total energy, and we can measure that in either the weak coupling or the strong coupling regime or any intermediate coupling regime. This would be the theory that you'd have of how the energy would change if you had a Tonk-Shirato gas, which is, say we're changing this by squeezing the atoms in the tube. Squeezing makes no difference for a Tonk-Shirato gas because they're already fermionized. There's no energy change associated with just being more tightly confined. And whereas if you were to squeeze and consider a Thomas Fermi gas, the energy goes up as you increase their interaction by squeezing them more tightly. But then the exact theory, which was Lieb-Linegar and then modified in Alshani's group, is this red curve, right, which shows you sort of a crossover from this behavior to this behavior. And I say, you know, with this limit, and then over here, it's some intermediate sort of thing. So we did the experiments, and these are the experimental points, and there are no free parameters, which is very gratifying about this, because we figure we know everything about the experimental system, and the theory is exact, so it should work out that it agrees. So that, you know, these points are coming from, these are high density points, these are low density points, and as we go from one side to the other, we're just squeezing them more and more tightly in the lattice. This is a little bit of an indirect way to tell about this physics of fermionization, right? Because when you see you do this squeezing, and it certainly changes the energy, but it's quantitatively, there's a big difference between, say, where this is relative to either of these curves. You know, the blue curve agrees over here, the green curve agrees over here, and the only curve that agrees with both is the red curve. Still a little bit indirect. So we figure the way to really measure something is if you can exactly get access to the point of overlap. So then what we decided to do is, through photo association, to measure specifically the probability of two particles being overlapped in one place. And this is what we measured. So this is G2, so it's the two-body correlation function at zero distance. So through a photo association technique, it actually tells us what is the probability of two particles being in the same place. And if it was a 3 dBc or extremely weakly coupled Bose gas, G2 would be 1. If it were fermions or a Planck-Shapiro gas, it would be 0. And here, this is a function of gamma in our experiment. That's the theory and that's the data. Right? So here, we're sort of directly seeing this sort of behavior. Here, we're seeing directly this kind of behavior. Right? So this is really the observation of Pauli exclusion for bosons for this different reason, having to do with interactions, not quantum statistics. And I like to hold this up as sort of an early example of the promise that these optical lattice systems hold for actually modeling condensed matter Hamiltonians, where you say, well, you know the Hamiltonian, and if you actually do the experiment, you'll see that you'll get the solution for that Hamiltonian. You know, this is a situation where we know the answer, but it's reasonable to expect that you might be able to get that answer even if you don't know the answer in advance. There's been really a lot of other work in 1D Bose gases, which in the interest of time, I'm not going to talk about in great degree. A number of experiments with low gamma that look at quasi-condensate behavior. And then the experiments in intermediate gamma or the high gamma get into that stronger coupling regime because they're using optical lattices, which gives you a little bit more tight confinement. So a number of properties have been measured in these intermediate regimes. One that I'll particularly point out is this work done by Bloch when he was at Munich, where if you put on an optical lattice in that one dimension, then that gives you a large effective mass in that motion, and then if you think about the parameter that we had for gamma, it gives you a large gamma in this lattice situation. And then what they observed is the momentum distributions, and the notable thing about the momentum distributions of a Planck-Shapiro gas is that they're not the same as for fermions, right? It's a different thing because that's a non-local property. That's where that absolute value sign, when you're comparing the Bose wave function to the Fermi wave function, becomes important. So you see a difference between momentum distributions in the one case or the other. We've also, in our 1D tubes, looked at the same thing. We haven't published this, where theory says the Fermi gas has something like a Fermi energy with a reasonably flat type distribution. And Planck-Shapiro gas is much more peaked. It's not like a Bose condensate, but it's certainly more like that than it's like a Fermi gas. So this is what we measure in the same case. And in order to do that, we try to shut off the interactions as much as we can during the expansion. That gives us access to the momentum distribution as opposed to the total energy. Right? So you see it qualitatively, it's like this. It's just that we can't completely shut off the interactions, so it just becomes a little bit more complicated. So this is what we see if you try to shut off the interactions. What we see, what you expect theoretically if you don't shut off the interactions, is that this Tangshir-Do gas will, as it expands, have a momentum which will evolve into exactly the same as the momentum of the Fermi gas. Right now, what we actually see is a long time after release, and this is sort of what we measure in our energy measurement, what we see is something which is closer to Gaussian distribution. And it makes sense when you average over the different numbers of atoms in each of our tubes that a whole bunch of distributions like this end up looking Gaussian when you put them all together. Okay, but the point of this to some degree is to show you that what we're usually measuring is Gaussian distributions on this expansion. So that brings us to our consideration of what's happening out of equilibrium. So the first thing to do is actually to consider these collisions that are happening in one dimension. So you have two particles in one dimension and they collide, and you can't tell, unless you have experience in PowerPoint, whether they've gone through each other or whether they've bounced off each other. Right? But if they're identical particles, the point is that there's no difference, right? They look the same whether they've reflected or they've transmitted. Because all they can do if they're reflecting is just exchange momentum. So in 1D, no matter what the interactions are like, if you have just a bunch of two-body collisions, they can't change your overall momentum distribution. But I say that from two-body collisions, but I've just shown you cases where the momentum distribution of an freely expanding 1D Bose gas does change. Right? You know it changes in the Thomas Fermi limit because mean field energy converts into kinetic energy. Tangshir-Do gas is this thing where, because of these interactions, this initial momentum distribution changes into this one. Right, so something is more going on when you have an interacting system, which is a little bit more complicated than just this. So we set out to ask this relatively straightforward question, which is, does a 1D Bose gas actually thermalize? And the background that you need for that is that these are delta function reaction systems are integrable. And what that should mean is that they don't ergodically sample phase space. And I'm going to say some approximately equal things here. Anyone who's spent any time considering quantum chaos and the like is likely to cringe at any of these identities. But I say from a practical point of view, ergodically sampling phase space is about the same as a system becoming chaotic, about the same as a system thermalizing. And I'd say to the extent that there are distinctions between these, that's part of the motivation for this work, to try to work out really what is the difference. You know, is there any difference between these different statements? You know, what really happens when things are thermalizing? So I just point out, for the delta function interacting gas, what that means is that if you have free body collision or any higher body collision, you have a certain number of momentum in, you get the same number, same specific momentum value out. Right? It's not just a two-body effect, it's a many-body effect. Okay, but still, thermalization in real 1D Bose gases was not really a decided question. I mean, people just figure, well, things thermalize, so there must be a way that they thermalize. For instance, the delta function interactions aren't perfect, and maybe that gives them a way to actually thermalize. We're in a longitudinal potential that lifts the integrability, and you know, maybe you see that in, you know, some finite time. I mean, usually systems just come to equilibrium. So what the procedure that we took was to just take the 1D gas as far out of equilibrium as we could, and then see what happens. So to create these non-equilibrium distributions, we'd first take our 1D gas and put on a standing wave pulse, and that you get diffraction, which gives you this momentum distribution, where you get a plus and minus 2 h bar k components. You can actually do better with two pulses. And two pulses with the appropriate spacing between them allows you to deplete the center region. You actually, if it was a little bit less strong interactions, you could deplete it a little bit better. But still, you're mostly getting rid of the stuff that's in the center. And you just get plus 2 h per k and minus 2 h per k. So that's an extremely out of equilibrium momentum distribution. So if you look at what happens after that point, those two sort of groups of atoms, or that superposition halves of atoms, are going to evolve in this way, right? Just like a regular motion in a harmonic trap. Right, where we start off from a situation which is like this, with a large velocity, and at a later time you have a small velocity and a large spread within the trap, and the like. And you see there's a certain similarity to this Newton's cradle, which no doubt you are all familiar with, but you may not be familiar with this particular mode of the Newton's cradle, right, which is the one where you set it going symmetrically. And I say this is the one that actually corresponds more closely to what we're doing in the lab, right, which is symmetrically setting the thing in that way. I didn't write that. Some publicity person at Penn State. Okay. I really got to get them to change that. Okay. So, but we don't have these classical Newton's cradles. We have quantum Newton's cradles, and they're quantum in the sense that they don't always reflect, which the steel balls always do. Are the actual atoms often go through each other, right? So sometimes they reflect, and sometimes they go through each other. That's the quantum aspect. And instead of just having five balls, we have between 50 and 300 per tube, and then there's thousands of these tubes that we're looking at. So when we set them going, and then we release them at various delay times during this oscillation, that essentially tells us what the velocity is at the point, at the time of release. And this is what we see for the first cycle. You see, you know, this is a sinusoidal oscillation of one half. This is a sinusoidal oscillation for the other half. And it goes on like that for a while. Now, if you sum these up all together, this is what the average looks like. I mean, it's a little hard to tell. It's not a thermal distribution. You'll see how it's not a thermal distribution. If you wait 15 cycles, then the motion dephases, right? Which is to say that after 15 cycles on this time scale, this picture doesn't change. Basically a stationary picture on that time scale. And that's because it's not quite a harmonic trap. And the anharmonicity is exactly what you need to explain this sort of dephasing. And then we can look at it a later time, 30 tau. So then what we do is we sum up the all the number of atoms in that line, so we get a linear picture to describe it. Before I do that, I'll just point out that in this picture where they've expanded by this much, that's about 1 millimeter from there to there. Each atom is confined about 40 nanometers, so it's a 25,000 to 1 aspect ratio within each tube, which is really very elongated. I mean, that's not why it's 1D, but I say, you know, it is certainly 1D-like in that way. Okay, so if I take these pictures and sum them up, the first cycle average of the green curves, we're going to focus on the distribution after 15 cycles where you get this blue curve. And these are at three different gammas, different initial conditions, different coupling strengths, we repeated the experiment. And so what we see is you see the blue curve, and then at a time that's later, in this case 40 cycles later, you get the red curve. And certainly something has changed. You've lost some atoms and there's a certain amount of rounding out. But it turns out there's a heating process that goes on in here. And you know, heating is ultimately due to scattering of to a weak scattering of lattice photons. And we can directly see that effect. So we do exactly the same experiment, but don't put on the grating pulses. And then you see a loss of atoms and a little bit of broadening of the distributions. So if we take this loss and this broadening and then decide what would happen to the blue curve at a later time, if that's the only thing that was going on, that is project the evolution of the blue curve given this, we can compare what the blue curve looks like at the later, would look like at the later time to the actual red curve to see if they're the same. And if they're the same, that means no thermalization has occurred, right? This is evolution without any thermal. And this is what we see, which is that there really, in every case, is pretty good agreement between what you project the thing would look like with no thermalization and what it actually looks like. And so the real bottom line conclusion from this work is that after dephasing, you've reached a steady state, and that steady state is not the same as thermal equilibrium. Right, thermal equilibrium, we know when we start off with something which was equilibrated in 3D, is a Gaussian distribution, which is, you can see the difference here from the dotted line, and these are pretty obvious, that difference. And if you're going to say, you know, what does that mean dynamically? It means that when we look at it after a long time, although the actual motion of each of those atoms is out of phase with all the other atoms, they're all still oscillating with the same amplitude that we first gave them at the beginning of the experiment. Now, if you're thinking about it, you say, well, okay, nothing happens. So you're saying there's no thermalization, but maybe there's just no collisions, right? You know, you're taking my word that something has happened in there that it's interesting. So you can do the same experiment just in 3D. And in 3D, we know it only takes about three collisions to thermalize. So this is the same thing. We just don't have the 2D lattice on and we let the atoms expand. And this is what we look at t equals zero, and you already see a little bit of the S-wave scattering sphere, and you know, something funny is going on a little bit. After two cycles, we're starting to fill up a thermal cloud in the center. By nine cycles, you can see almost no remnant of what was there at the beginning. And you know, this is actually a thermalization timescale, which is less than two cycles, even though the density in the 3D case is much lower, right, because they're not tightly confined in these traps. One thing I'd also like to point out about this is that these collisions are occurring way above the Landau critical velocity, which you can sort of see because these two clouds are separated from each other. Right, the mean field is what gives them their size over here, and they're separated by much more than the energy of the mean field interaction. So this effect that I'm talking about, the suppression, is not because it's a quantum degenerate gas. Right, it's not a quantum degenerate phenomenon. In fact, the temperatures that they would thermalize is well into the thermal regime, well above quantum degeneracy. Right, so what we're seeing for this suppression is just a reduction of thermalization because of this dimensionality. So we can actually quantitatively set a lower limit on the thermalization, and we do that by, on the one hand, comparing the projected to the actual curve to each other. So that's plotted down from here, the chi-squared, and then we compare that actual distribution to a Gaussian of the same total energy and the same number. And then we just assume any difference after that time is due to a step along the way towards thermalization. It's a somewhat conservative approach because there's going to be an inevitable difference between these two things just because of noise in the data. And when we do that, we get that we can project into a large number of cycles ahead before the thermalization is going to occur, and each of those we can then count how many reflection collisions have occurred, and we set lower limits in every case. But if we don't see any evidence of thermalization, it's just that because of the various details of how non-equilibrium we can set up the initial state, or in this intermediate case, we can actually set a limit of about 10,000 collisions. And I point out that these limits are not sensitive to how we did that projection, because really that heating is a small amount of the total energy. I mean, it's a very small correction. The dominant thing is just that they're not changing their overall distribution by a lot. And I guess it's probably obvious, but in each case, these are much greater than three. So something is going on in one dimension. Okay, so if there's integrability, or at least the amount of integrability that we have in these systems, there's no thermalization. And Miguel talked about the theory that's been generated in the time since we did this experiment. Actually, that's now PRL, where you can actually get what the final distribution is from this constrained equilibrium using a generalized Gibbs distribution. And I'll just go on because Miguel talked about that. So the next question we had is there a threshold for non-integrability, at least the thermalization? And the reason we're asking this question is because this is sort of a central part of nonlinear dynamics and classical physics. This KAM theory shows that if you have an integrable system, then we know it never becomes chaotic. But if what was surprising had been demonstrated in computer experiments by Fermi in the 50s, is that even if you're not completely integrable, even if you're a little bit non-integrable, you still don't actually ergodically sample all of phase space. You're very constrained in your evolution. So the question we're really asking experimentally, is there a quantum mechanical analog to this KAM theorem in classical physics? And I say people have worked on it theoretically, and to my knowledge, it's a very difficult problem. It has not actually been tractable. So the procedure to do this is that we lift the integrability and then measure the thermalization to see what happens. Now, we have some ways to lift the integrability. You can allow tunneling between the tubes, and it makes these 1D systems look a little bit more like, say, 2D or 3D systems. You can relax this delta function interaction thing to give you finite range interactions, and then you lose your integrability. Or we can add some axial potential, either a periodic potential, or you can imagine changing the confining potential, and those are all viable ways to make it so it's not an integrable system. Now, what we do is we actually reduce the depth of the tube. And what that does is it does this, but it also does this. So it does two things at once, which is experimentally, I mean, it's the easy thing to change. It's just it kind of complicates the analysis of it. So we lower the lattice depth. So with a deep lattice, through these curves, and that would correspond to no evolution, no thermalization. At a shallower lattice, you look at these later times, and they gradually approach what ends up fitting like a good Gaussian at a later time. So we can look at the time constant for this, for how this thermalization occurs, and this is what we see as a function of lattice depth, the thermalization rate. So when the lattice is very deep, the thermalization rate is just limited by the instrumental resolution, this lower limit that we can set. And as the lattice is very shallow, eventually, you know, it's going to be about a third. This is normalized the number of collisions that are occurring. And so, you know, this thing, it's not changing over there, and then it starts going up at that point. Now, there's one other thing that happens when we do this, and that is that energy leaves the one dimension. Right, that is, we start off all the energy in one dimension, and it's just that if the lattice is sufficiently shallow, since all we ever measure is the one-dimensional energy coming out, we see that that energy decreases. So it must be going into some sort of transverse motion. So this is once we start seeing this energy decrease, we actually fit these using the half the time constant that we got from the thermalization curves. And you see, this is lower and lower lattice depth, we get more and more thermalization. And eventually, more and more loss of energy. And eventually, you lose the energy so quickly that all you do is just measure any point at this time, and it's already steady state. So you put these all together. This is our thermalization as a function of lattice depth, and this is the fraction of energy left in 1D as a function of lattice depth. So starts off, it's 1D, all the energy is in 1D. And then eventually, when the lattice is turned off, and I actually don't have that point in the curve, but it is one-third, we measured it, you have equipartition of energy, same in all directions. But then it sort of continuously changes from one to the other. And you see, you know, where this happens, where we start to see the loss of energy is actually, although there's a certain amount of instrumental resolution, it's a little bit to the left of where we start to see the thermalization. So one other thing to note from this graph, which just to give you a sense for what may or may not be going on, is that if you have two atoms that are colliding within the tube that are both in the ground state, the first thing that's allowed by parity for them to happen is that one of them, if they have enough energy, then one of them can be excited to the second vibrational level. Now, if you look how much energy is required to do that on this curve, that's this green curve. Right? So at the point where we start seeing thermalization, we're well below this threshold for this being allowed to happen. Right? And it's a situation where if it hasn't started thermalizing yet, there really are no tails to this distribution. Right? This distribution is pretty close to flat top because of the way we set it up, and you know, it's got nothing out in the ends. So two-body collisions, at least, or then you know, you'd have to have four-body collisions in order to actually have enough energy to do this, and you're below that threshold. I'd also point out that the width of this lowest band is extremely narrow, way too narrow to account for the amount of energy that we lose transversely. So one possible scenario, and I'm not claiming that this is the correct scenario, I'm just saying this is something which is roughly consistent with the way things are going, is that if you look at Olshani's calculation for this delta function interacting gas, he showed that it's a good identity when this thing is negligible, that order k cubed term. But when we put in this large amount of kz, that term is no longer small. It's about 0.8, which means that these are finite range interactions. They're no longer delta function interactions in 1D. So if there's finite range interactions, then if you have three momenta coming in, you can have three different momenta coming out, right? And perfectly well conserve energy, and it's allowed if it's a non-integrable system. So perhaps the actual sequence of events is that you start because of this finite range interactions to get some thermal tails, and then the thermal tails then ultimately allow you to have these transverse excitations at some level, and then you get in the end, after as you have a low enough lattice depth, some 3D thermalization. So the question we set out to answer is there a threshold? So here, this is thermalization rate plotted up as a function of tunneling amplitude, right? Which is just to say plot up as a function of something which is proportional e to the minus u naught. And one thing I see is tunneling amplitude here, where we start to see thermalization, is 0.1 nanokelvin, right? It's extremely tightly bound and very little tunneling. So it's hard to see that it would be tunneling. And here, it kind of looks, although you know exactly what's going on over there you could kind of argue about, it looks like there might be no threshold. But then again, it's not obvious that tunneling is important, that that's the right thing to be plotting at all over here. So, you know, you could plot something else. You know, what if you plotted 1 over the square root of u naught, which would be 1 over the vibrational frequency? Well, if we did that, clearly there's a huge threshold, right, where you need to have that really sufficiently large before you get any thermalization at all. Or if you do any power, it's like 1 over u naught, 1 over u naught the third. Actually, I think this is 1 over u naught to the... Yeah, okay, 1 over u naught to the third. You see, you know, they would clearly have thresholds. That's the kind of thing they were looking at. It's just that, you know, I could plot up a lot of things. The point is that there's a need for theory in order to actually address this problem and understand it. And there are people who are working on it, but maybe it's a little plug. There's a lot of space for trying to figure something more out about the system, which I think has a certain generality. So just to sum up what I've said, we have experiments in equilibrium, and they give the exact results for the Liebling-Linegar theory, right, when we have delta function interactions. We take the things out of equilibrium, and we see that if it's a delta function interacting Bose gas, they don't thermalize, right? Just like what you'd expect if they're just integrable systems. But then when we relax the conditions and allow them to thermalize, then they certainly do approach this Gaussian distribution, but exactly how and why is an open question. And then the other question, which I mean, I think the answer to it is probably yes, but you know we don't know until we sort of get the appropriate interaction between experiment and theory here, is the question is this a universal behavior, right? That is it going to be possible to use these experiments to actually then get an in to something like a quantum mechanical version of a KEM theorem or the absence of a KEM theorem, something like that. But hopefully we'll know at the next KITP meeting. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions?
So, I mean, usually when people are talking about gamma, the experiments, the calculations are done at low temperature. Although there have been calculations by Jura to look at higher temperatures. And so the basic answer is until you get to a very high temperature, the low G2 at zero, at if you're in the Tang-Schwerdt regime or to high gamma, is pretty well preserved, right? So when we consider these Newton's cradles, there what we actually quote is the effective gamma that it has, sort of the average over the tubes, at just the lower density associated with them being spread out over that larger volume, right? So presumably, the short answer would be yes. I mean, I think it's eventually the temperature has an effect on it. But especially in the mid to high gamma region, it doesn't have an effect for quite a long time. Okay, so you might expect from that as long as it stays a Tang-Schwerdt gas, then it's just two-body collisions and nothing's going to happen for thermalization. But we're doing most of these things where we took them out of equilibrium and then looked for thermalization was really right in the middle of the intermediate coupling regime. So presumably, you know, it has the features of both regions in it. You know, there the effective gamma would be around 3.
Where you talk about deviations from the delta interactions.
So this one?
Yes. I mean, is this because here you have much higher excitation energy?
So the reason this changes is because KZ is the collision energy. So when we're doing all that stuff in equilibrium, they just have this energy associated with these tiny distributions. But then we hit him with this plus or minus, with this grading pulse, which gives you plus or minus 2 h-bar-k. Mm-hmm. So then you start to have collisions, which are actually 2 h-bar-k this way, 2 h-bar-k this way.
Yeah.
And I just point out that that k is not really relevant to the 1D system. That's just the k that we actually gave the pulses with. Right, so that's why that's a much higher value.
This is something you also had in the experiments where you were strictly speaking in 1D and you didn't see
stabilization.
Yeah, that's right. So it's always there.
So that's always there, but which is to say that, I mean, that's why we were, it's one of the motivations for looking at this lower depth. The question is, okay, we can set a very stringent lower limit on thermalization. But the question is, if we had more sensitivity, would we have seen thermalization at that point? Or not, and that's part of this question about whether there's a threshold, right? Which is that, you know, that was that lower limit just, you know, if we'd done better, would we eventually have seen it, or not? And I think that's right now an experimental question, and ultimately maybe an experimental / theoretical question.
I have a question about the three body collisions. From your measured rate, the reduction in G2, you can infer the three-body reduction.
Yeah, I mean...
And therefore, you could perhaps discriminate, or put independent answers on the role of three-body collisions in fact, the subsequent experiment.
I would go one step further. I mean, if we could tell more readily what the density dependence was of the thermalization rate right at that threshold, then we could directly answer the question of whether it's three-body or two-body collisions. It turns out to be a little bit tricky to do that, because if you increase the density, which is the direction that you want to go, increase the density, then you have something where it's so close to thermal already that it's hard to get the same kind of resolution. And show you it. This curve. So, if you try to change, if you say we're interested in whether it's an n cube dependence or an n squared dependence over here, if you go in either direction from where we are, either higher or lower density, the instrumental resolution goes up. Right. So, right at the point where you want to answer that question experimentally, you can't do it. I agree that by calculations there must be some way to actually get it, but it's kind of complicated. I mean, I think we need an expert in the actual calculation of things as opposed to the experimental realization of things to get to it. So, I mean, I think right now Vladimir Yurovsky is working on this problem, and maybe other people who work on the problem. I mean, it's a little hard. I mean, you have you can certainly say what G2 is. I mean, the first thing to do would be to say, well, we know what G2 at zero is. So wherever there's a two-body collision, there's a three-body collision to that rate. But then the question is, well, how close do the particles have to be for it to count as a three-body collision? I mean, if you start looking at it in detail, it's not a very simple problem. I mean, it must be an answerable question. But I don't know.
Last question.
So maybe I'm missing just some pi or something, but... But when you say that KZ A perp is of order 1, isn't that the same as saying that the collision energy is of the order of H bar omega perp? I thought you had a graph where they were vastly off. But, but if I just square that equation again.
You're saying...
You said KZ what? A perp is
0.8. It is 0.8, that's right.
But that, that means that H bar squared KZ squared over M.
No, I mean, I'll tell you, the numbers for the excitation to the, first it's a second vibrational level that you go to. That's 18 recoils, right? And the total amount of energy that you have available in this collision is 8 recoils, right? Ever. All right, that's okay. 8 recoils. So... Yeah, I mean, maybe there's a factor of 2 pi squared or something, but I mean, it's enough. I mean, I'm including all the factors of 2 pi when I'm saying that that's KZ times A perpendicular is 0.8.
Right.
Although, whether 0.8 is the relevant point for some reason or not, I don't know. Right. I just point out it's certainly not something which can be neglected out of hand.
Okay.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.